Thanks for listening to the Adam Carolla Show on Podcast One.
Rocket Mortgage, confidence. Support for the Adam Carolla Show comes from our friends at Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Why can't clients get approved in minutes, not weeks? Or make adjustments to their rate and term in real time? Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans answered those questions and more. It gives you the confidence to buy a home or refinance your existing loan. Fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. That's right. That's what Rocket Mortgage does. Whether you're looking to buy your first home or your 10th, with Rocket Mortgage, you get a transparent online process. Apply simply, understand fully, mortgage confidently. What else do you need to know? And again, these guys support the show and are great sponsors. So, Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. To get started, just go to rocketmortgage.com/Adam. That's rocketmortgage.com/Adam.
Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLS, consumeraccess.org, number 3030. From Corolla One Studios in Glendale, California, this is the Adam Carolla Show. Adam's guest today, the director of The Zen Diaries of Gary Shandling, Judd Apatow. With Gina Grad on news, Paul Bryan on sound effects, another round of March Gradness, and Jeff Cesario does the sports with Jet Waterhouse. And now, Lynch didn't write an intro joke today, because his biorhythm wheel said it was an extra critical day. Adam Carolla.
Yeah, get it on. Got to get on. No choice but get on mandate. Get it on. Thank you for tuning in. Thanks for telling a friend. Thanks to Blinds Galore for sponsoring this front half of the show. Visit blindsgalore.com and ZipRecruiter. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/Adam. Good day, Gina Grad.
Good day to you.
And Bald Brian.
You're not funny. I'm disappointed.
I am excited that Judd Apatow is in studio. I have watched The Zen Diaries of Gary Shandling, part one and part two, coming up March 26, 8 o'clock on HBO. That's part one. And then part two is the Tuesday, the following day. Fantastic work. I saw Judd's stand-up special last night. I saw Funny People came on.
Cramming for the test.
Funny People just showed up, and we were talking about Eric Bana on Funny People. He was in here a few weeks ago, and I was thinking, oh, yeah, I haven't seen that movie in a while. And it was just on Saturday night. The picture in Adam Sandler's office as the dying comedian, at least at the time, behind him was a picture of Gary Shandling, which is the cover art of the doc, and you must have put that there and known that.
That's right. Yeah, I think it's, I don't know if it's in Adam's office or Seth's office, but it's an amazing photograph that Mark Seliger took, and it's Gary in front of a desk that's on fire. And Mark said, back then, we didn't have CGI. We just lit a desk on fire.
Yeah, they just called Bobcat over, told him he was doing panel, and let nature take its course.
Exactly.
So
I'm picturing you in a beautiful mind-style room with all these funny people over here, Shandling over here, make all the connections.
And so it was weird because when I saw the documentary and I saw the art that came along with it, I thought, oh, that's cool, the way Judd cooked that up, pardon the pun, like superimposed a picture of Shandling and put the fire behind him and stuff. And then we went back to 2009 and Funny People, and there was that picture, I think, sitting behind Adam Sandler. So there you go.
Saved a lot of cash.
I am so impressed with Judd because I look at him as a custodian of comedy. If the custodian also was a guidance counselor, principal, and a gym coach.
Exactly.
As well, and an architect of school who built schools.
I feel like our careers are turning into the same career. We're doing stand-up. We're making documentaries.
That's right.
We're writing. We're directing. I feel like we're becoming the same person.
Yeah. Wildly successful both,
Yeah.
Yeah, you know what it's like, I think, with you and I? If you look at the car auctions, every once in a while, like I do, I look at all the expensive car auctions. They'll have a pontoon Ferrari Testarossa 1954, and it's $37 million is the estimate. And then you go scroll down the page, and you see the exact same car, and the estimate is $30,000 to $50,000. And you go, what? And then you go, oh, that's the kids' version. It's actually a shrunken down version
like
of it. It's still
car.
A nice piece.
Wow. Exactly.
It's still, it's not a bad, it wouldn't be bad to have that in your garage, but it's
yes.
not. I look at that as my career, and you're the actual full scale Ferrari.
That's not
car.
How I see it.
I'm the Barbie car.
Yeah.
I do not see it that way. I
people love Barbies.
I love crashing as well.
Oh,
it,
thank you.
It is absolutely, we had Pete in here a few weeks ago too, and it's just one of my, I don't have a lot of must-see TV, but that's it for me. And the thing about crashing, and you tell me, one of the problems you have when you do, when you depict stand-up comedy is the audience at home not laughing nearly as hard as the audience in the club is laughing when Sally Fields is doing her stand-up set with Tom Hanks in the wings. Right. But when you watch, like the last one was the roast battle, roast war you guys had where he was having to reluctantly roast everybody because Pete's such a nice guy. The material is fantastic. And you can't fake the material because if it's bad, then you're sitting on your sofa thinking,
yeah.
This is bad.
Well, that's the fun of the show is that, you know, if we do a roast battle episode, we just hire the same people that write the roast battles. And then we shoot it with the crowd and we try to almost make it a stand-up special or a documentary of those stand-up moments. So instead of doing what a normal movie does, which is just, you know, they get their close up. There's no crowd there. They add the laughs after. You know, if we're doing a sequence where Pete's bombing, you know, I'll just, you know, say, do your set. He's like, what if they laugh? I go, well, we'll do a second take and do it again. And the second time they just won't laugh. We won't tell the crowd anything.
Right.
Or there was a scene where Artie and Bill Burr are being interviewed by Joy Behar.
Right.
And we wanted to capture what the 92nd Street Y Q&A panel felt like. So instead of, you know, scripting it, we had a line or two. We said, let's just let them talk for a half an hour. We'll find a little piece of it.
Right.
And I think that's why it's more authentic. We're really doing it. If there's a clip of Greg Fitzsimmons doing stand-up, we just shot his set for a half an hour and then grabbed a minute or two.
Right. It all has that feel of this is exactly what it is versus the sort of CGI world. And it's so much better to watch an actual car chase than a CGI car chase.
Yeah, you could just tell.
You just can tell. And that's one good part that's still left in us about being a human. I don't know if our kids are going to have that part where we can tell the difference between real pussy and robot pussy.
It's you know, you look at the animated adult films and you just go, it just doesn't do anything. Does that do something for certain people?
No, and I have
a
thing.
Well, they must exist for a reason.
I first off, just anime in general is weird to me.
Mm-hmm. It's off-putting.
It's off-putting. And as somebody who prides himself on being semi-racist, it's racist with the big round saucer eyes on the Asian women. Like, it's a weird thing. Like, hey, we've taken your eyes and we've converted them to Anglo eyes times 1,000, and that's the eyes you shall have. I mean, when you watch Speed Racers, I grew up watching a Speed Racer. Everyone's eyes were just huge, but they was all shot in Japan. Oh, not shot, all.
Yeah,
penned in Japan. Yeah.
This is why we all still love the French Connection, because when they shot it, they just went 100 miles an hour in the streets of New York, putting everyone's lives in danger, and that's how they would do it back then. They didn't really tell people to get off the streets or anything.
They didn't do a whole lot of pulling of permits back then.
No permits.
So Judd, the documentary's amazing. And Chandling, it's really, I think everyone appreciated Chandling or understood what he did for TV and how innovative he was. But now there's two, you know, it's the Gary Chandling show and the Larry talk Sanders. Show and Larry Sanders. So he has two sort of groundbreaking break down the fourth wall and one of them. And the other one is just totally innovative. So times two, yes.
Well,
Brian.
To your point, I think this documentary, The Zen Diaries of Gary Chandling, is made for people of my generation, of my age, who were a little too young for Larry Sanders and a little too poor for Larry Sanders. He had shows on Showtime and HBO, neither of which I saw because we couldn't afford Showtime or HBO, so I didn't get the Gary Chandling thing, and now seeing him put in context, comedically, historically, is so much more helpful to someone like me. Like, I understand people love Gary Chandling and worship him, but I never understood exactly why because I didn't watch those shows, and now I'm sort of getting it because I watched the first part.
Yeah, it was It's a brilliant documentary, and it just shows, I guess, you tell me, because writing, directing, TV, documentaries, do you just feel like storytelling is storytelling is storytelling?
I think so. And the best compliment I got on the documentary was someone said, it feels a little bit like your movies. And I thought that was good, because my movies are just trying to show that life is mysterious and hard, and we're all just trying to be happy, and we have all these obstacles along the way, and it's a mess, and we just hope we evolve and get a little better. And that really is a story of Gary's life. You know, you're wounded as a kid, bad shit happens, it fucks you up, it makes you a certain kind of person, you spend the rest of your life trying to heal, trying to figure out how to make a living or turn this pain into laughter. And then at the end of his life, he decided to, you know, not worry about his career and be more of a mentor and just be there for everybody when they needed help and advice. And in a way, I think that's everybody's life. We're just trying to figure out how to survive and hopefully evolve in a positive way.
Well, Gary, I guess he lost his brother when he was young.
Yeah, his brother had cystic fibrosis. And so when Gary was 10, his brother was 13, died. And when you see the video of it, you realize, I've never seen Gary look this happy when his brother was alive. He just seems like a really sweet, peaceful kid. And back then, I think a lot of people, you know, when a child would die, the family didn't talk about it. So I think what happened was his parents just soldiered on, and they never talked about it. So you had this little kid who no one told him how to grieve. No one told him how to get over it. Mm. And I think it led to him becoming a very sensitive, nervous person. And also it led to him spending a lot of time alone, because I think the family became somewhat obsessed with him. He was the surviving kid. So how he dealt with it was going in his room, going on his ham radio, talking to people from around the world, and getting into comedy. And then comedy becomes, you know, your escape pod. Mm. And he was able to leave home and start this career.
He never had kids. He had girlfriends and things, but yeah. Did he marry?
He was engaged at one point to Linda Doucette, and they lived together for a while. And that's part of the documentary, is that...
She's working on the show, right?
That she was on the show. She played Hank Kingsley's assistant, and was really funny and very nice to me. When I first met Gary, I was in my early 20s, and I would hang out with him almost like a surrogate son. I always felt like I was the experimental son. Mm-hmm. And I'd have dinner with them and just spend a ton of time with them. And then at some point they broke up and Gary fired her from the show, which was totally wrong. You're just not allowed to do that. If you're dating someone on the show, you're not allowed to dump them from the show when you break up. So she sued him for wrongful termination. And in suing him, Gary went through all of his financial stuff and realized that his manager was not handling his business in an ethical way, and wound up suing his manager. And that became this big lawsuit that was really ugly. And 7 years after the lawsuit, he gets a knock at his door, and it's the FBI. And they say, this private eye, Anthony Pelicano, had been bugging your phone all through this lawsuit. And Gary had to testify against Anthony Pelicano. Wow. In that trial, and he went to jail for 15 years.
Pelicano, I remember he was involved in many Hollywood cases he was up to this nefarious activities. Brad Gray was his manager. Brad Gray just passed, right?
That's part of what's so tragic about it, is you have these two guys who met when they
Brad Gray was a kid, right?
He was like 22 when he started managing Gary. This is the strange part. He was Harvey Weinstein's partner.
Yeah, the old pictures were together.
They started a management company together in Buffalo. They signed Gary and Bob Saget, Dave Coulier. And, you know, they had this terrible lawsuit. Gary, you know, because it was a brotherly relationship, when he felt like he had been violated, it was very personal to Gary, and he sued him for $100 million. And ultimately, Brad had to pay him a lot of money and return his percentage of the ownership of the Larry Sanders Show back to Gary. But what's so tragic about it is, you know, Brad died of cancer this year. Gary died 2 years ago. And it's, you know, it says a lot about show business and ego and what this town can do to friendships and how money becomes too important. Gary felt like he was standing up for himself. It was very important to him. And he also was paranoid, and he would say that he thought his phone was being bugged, and we all looked at him like he was nuts. I mean, people didn't take him very seriously. They thought, wow, Gary's so neurotic. And then he finds out 7 years later, they were bugging Kevin Nealon's phone. They were bugging Linda's phone. And everything that he feared was actually happening. And what's so strange about it is that's what Harvey Weinstein was doing to all these women, is he had these ex-Mossad agents pretending to be journalists or other people who had been victimized. And it is kind of the same playbook of it's kind of like Trump and Stormy Daniels. It's this. There's a
pattern.
World of PIs and how people are manipulated and abused. That's fascinating.
I am so. I don't know. Part of me is jealous, but you know when they tell these stories where they go, well, this guy was a big comedian. He had money. So, of course, he had his ladies on the side. But his wife, she looked the other way. But he'd go out for sometimes 2-3 nights in a row, not come back to the wife and kids. You know, he'd be drinking and playing cards and with his ladies. And I'd go, wait a minute, aren't I the rich comedian now? How come I get yelled at when I don't come home with Chinese food? What is it? How did this work? And then people do this sort of, they wax nostalgic or poetic, like they're like, yeah, he loved the ladies, you know? I like ladies.
My wife's mad at me. I'm here right now.
Right. It's this weird, I don't know, but simpler times, but, so, you, let's talk about you. I'm envious, and I have another thought. Do you feel, as I feel, a lot of comedians get to this point, and maybe Gary got to it, he died, how old was he when he died?
66.
66 when he died. I feel like Jim Carrey's here now, you're getting to this point where the beginning part is all about the grind and it's all about the work and it's all about getting stage time. And then the second part is about how much money and how many deals and what can we do and what can I put my name on? And at a certain point, this philosophical part starts to rein in. Yeah. And if you listen to guys like Jim Carrey, it's all about giving back and being at peace and I'm happier than I've ever been because I'm not on the treadmill anymore. And maybe Gary was there and maybe you're entering that zone. I wonder if there's something in the mind of a comedian that once you spring that gray pube on your nutsack, you'd start turning that way. Cause I don't feel like welders do that, like, or roofers or bankers. I just feel like they just kind of start, you know, lawyers, they just start when they start and they die when they die, but they don't have that sort of, it's not a midlife crisis. It's sort of a midlife, what's it all about? What are we doing? It's not
an existential crisis.
Yeah, it's not like I need a Corvette. It's I need to give back and I need to hug my kids more.
I think that, it's a really fascinating, complex question. I think you got to the root of the whole thing. I remember I went to this acupuncturist, this old Japanese woman, and we were just talking about fear of death. And she said, you know, Judd, the thing is, you're built to fear death while you have a lot of energy and you're young and you want to do things and accomplish things. But you'll see as you get older, it starts to go away. And then by the end of your life, you're ready to let go. And you're built that way. Everyone is built that way. So on some level, you could say there's something specific about rich people, famous people who've had their dreams come true, who realize that what life is about, the joy of life, may not be that you hosted the Tonight Show. It may not be that you accomplished this. You might realize like, oh, all those things I thought would make me happy, I'm one of the rare people who got to do them. And maybe it was more fun just hanging out with my friends. Maybe it was more fun playing with my kids or whatever. And so I think a lot of those guys have that crisis because they do have an experience that very few people have, which is, does your dreams coming true make you happy? And welding is hard, but as someone who used to wash dishes and bus tables and stuff, there was a great joy in washing dishes. There was a great mental freedom in not sitting home going, if I don't think of another good joke, this is all over. Like there's a mental stress in the arts that people don't understand, where I would just laugh my ass off all night long washing dishes. Like, here's the dish, clean it, put it back. I would just laugh. I'd sing Who songs all night long. And so I think it's a different experience a lot of people are having. And it's hard for people who do manual labor to understand the torture of wondering if you'll ever write a hit song again, and doubting yourself and hating yourself. I mean, all these bands, you're like, what? I'm sure, like, I always think about, like, REO Speedwagon. They're just going, like, why the fuck can't I write another hit song? And that is, that might be a worse feeling than just working hard every day and going home and having accomplished your thing. Mm-hmm. So I have compassion for everyone, and I think it's all interesting.
So there's a thought, which is, if you wash dishes or you swing a hammer, clean carpets, or you do what I used to do, or what Judd and many people used to do, work at McDonald's, once you punch out, like you literally punch out,
yes,
and then you go home. Now, it's a small apartment and you're on a futon and you have some roommates, but you're done.
Yeah.
And I didn't go home from McDonald's and think about how to construct a better burger.
Yeah.
I was done.
Yeah.
And when I was done, construction was 3:30 Friday, done. Like Fred Flintstone, down the dinosaur's tail, and pow, off to the drive-in theater. And I never, sat around on a Saturday ruminating about Joyce Hangers or Tico clips. I was just done.
Yeah.
And I would work some odd jobs on weekends and things like that. But, I mean, my head wasn't filled with thoughts of what about.
Yeah.
And so the thing about comedy, and I guess you could say the same thing about what Mark Geragos does. You never really get to punch out.
Right.
You can take your dog for a walk, but you're going to be thinking about the case, thinking about the special, thinking about cutting the Shandling doc. You know, you never really have that escape, per se.
Yeah.
And it's impossible to escape it, because as long as you're awake. And by the way, I have dreams about doing sets and doing comedy and editing stuff and stuff like that. You never really can escape it. So there's probably something to be said for jobs that literally have a time clock where you just punch out.
Well, it is about the satisfaction you get from work. Gary made the Larry Sanders Show, which was, making fun of a fictionalized talk show host who was such an egomaniac that he would go home after taping the show and immediately watch the show. So I just did an interview with Larry King, and his wife was on an early episode of its Gary Shandling Show. And the first thing he says to me is, yeah, he said when they used to go out on dates, they'd watch the show. And that's what Gary was making fun of, is the idea that being famous makes you happy, and that you're chasing it and chasing it and chasing it, and you don't realize that what should make you happy is just the people in the office. Gary used to say, the Larry Sanders Show is about people who love each other, but show business gets in the way, this chasing it all the time. And it's hard to know if people who can shut it off, they put on the game and they're happy. Sometimes I'm sitting home and say I'm just hanging out. Part of my head's going, the next script isn't good yet.
Right.
When will it be good? Maybe it'll never be good. Maybe I'll work on it for 3 years, and the day it comes out, the whole world will go, Judd, what you just did was shit.
Yeah.
And it's a strange feeling.
You're the next REO Speedwagon. The REO Speedwagon of REO Judd Wagon of comedy.
Yeah. And I love REO Speedwagon. I like the new stuff.
That notion of, I always talk about that step backwards moment is the worst. That moment where you realize so if you're REO Speedwagon, you should be happy, except for you're not, possibly because everything's in the rearview mirror.
Exactly. It's like being a football player or something, and you have a moment of glory, and what does it feel like? There are certain people who, they switch jobs or they go into politics, and football players have another part of their lives, and then some just talk about that era. Mm. And I think the thing that Gary did, and that Jim Carrey does sometimes, is they try to take a real break and go, if I wasn't this guy that you all think I am, who am I? Like, who am I without comedy? Who am I without show business or without anyone recognizing me? And they were spiritual people, and Jim is a spiritual person who's trying to explore his essence without being Ace Ventura, without being Larry Sanders. What is that? And I think what's fascinating about Gary is he decided that the best part of him was the giving part. And in his journals near the end of his life, he just wrote, you know, give to others, that's the win. And that's where he got to.
Where did all the journals come from? How did you find out about them and obtain them and all that?
Gary talked about them a little bit, but I put together his memorial service, and I was putting a book together of photos, and I asked his estate if I could scan some pages in these journals, which I had stumbled upon as we cleaned up his house. And I realized instantly that there was a movie in Gary's life and these journals. And Gary...
Now, let me cut you off.
Yeah.
Judd Apatow can't go to a deceased friend's house and clean up and put some shit in a box without stopping and going, this is a movie. See, whereas my mom could happily come over, clean up all your shit and leave and not be burdened with the work. You're literally cleaning out a loved one's house and working. Like you're not, doesn't feel like work, but your brain never punched out.
Exactly. There may be something wrong with me. My kids, when I'm gone, they will have a dumpster pulled up to the house. They will toss it all in, hard drives. There's the lack of interest in all the ephemera of my life is startling.
My kids are going to fire a flare gun in slow motion just through a sliding glass window and then slowly walk away. Yeah. Again, it's all in slow motion. They're not even going to pull a dumpster up. That's expensive.
Yeah, it's hard. I mean, it's hard to shut that off. And I think Gary was someone that I always thought was being forgotten. He didn't work a lot in the last 10 years of his life. And I always try to remind people so much of modern comedy comes from Gary's work. You know, these guys who wrote for It's Gary Shandling Show, they all went and made The Simpsons. And they said that a lot of the reason why was Gary just blew the wall open of what was possible in a sitcom. Sitcoms used to all look like All in the Family, and they were very simple. And then suddenly Gary took this imaginative approach. And Sam Simon, who worked at It's Gary Shandling Show, was one of the creators of The Simpsons. And Reese and Gene worked at It's Gary Shandling Show. And then at Larry Sanders, the same thing. That kind of awkward documentary feel comedy is now what most comedies are.
I will tease this. I'm always envious of people who know what they want to do at an early age. And Judd knew what he wanted to do at an early age. Hence, he has a lot of interviews, interviewing a lot of super notable comedians from when he was, 15, 16.
Yeah.
And so Judd knew he was on this trajectory. Now, the question is sort of, and I'm not sure if it's answerable, but was Judd's ability propelling him, or was it his desire and love of all things comedy that propelled him and then developed the ability as you embarked on this journey?
Second one.
Yeah, but how could you be funny? I mean, how could you make yourself funny? Well, no one is really funny at 15, but there's funny for 15.
Hard to say. I look at my old stand-up from when I did it in my early 20s, and it is awful.
But that's a chick looking at her hairstyle from the 80s. Yeah. Like, it's always just Spuds McKenzie posters in the background. Like, it's always a disaster. But you can't really say, oh, you were a dog.
Yeah.
You can say, oh, your hair looked like everyone else's fucked up hair. And that time period, and it's kind of, it can go no other way. You can't be a fantastic stand-up comedian when you're 17 and a half. Or even 22, and there's occasional Chris Rocks or whatevers, but you can't really judge it by being harsh on your old stand-up. In order to write these movies, in order to do what you do, you have to have an ability, and it can't just all be desire, and it can't just be all developed from a desire, no more than you could wish long yourself into the NBA because you just love the power forward position. All right, we'll get into this a little deeper. I want to know how it started, but first I'll tell you guys about Blinds Galore. They're having their friends and family sale. It's going on now. Everything up to 50% off. Their biggest sale of the year won't last forever, so hurry. BlindsGalore.com. We use them here. I have them in the edit bays. We have them in the studios. I have them at home. They are everywhere. There's a window. They're high quality, 100% custom built blinds and shades created to your exact measurements. Over 15 years experience, over 2 million windows and counting. They have a team of experts. They're located out in San Diego, California. They'll help you online or over the phone. They'll send out free samples. You get it all dialed in. And then you'll get the custom blinds and shades you've always wanted. Blinds galore. They'll even set you up with free samples. I think up to like 10 or 12 colors. I've picked them out before. Drew has them. I have them. Everyone here has them. Free shipping on top of free expertise. It's blinds galore. Dawson.
Blinds galore makes it easy to get the 100% custom blinds and shades you've always wanted in your home. Their friends and family sale is going on now, so check out blindsgalore.com before it ends on March 28th. Let them know we send you. That's blindsgalore.com.
So, Judd, early and often for you, I mean, you, I don't know if you knew what you'd be doing, but you knew comedy was, mm-hmm. was going to be in the picture, and you had the wherewithal and the chutzpah and the whatever to go interview all these comedians at such a young age. Was there any other choice for you, or was it always comedy? And did you know what you wanted to do within comedy?
It's so funny because I had to think about all this because I just taped one of those master class, mm-hmm. You know, how you can go online and like buy a course. And I had to come up with like 5 hours of talking about this. So I have recently thought it through. And, you know, what happened was I was 10. My grandma was great friends with a comedian named Toadie Fields.
Sure.
Who was like a Joan Rivers type.
She was a big gal, right?
Yeah, and hysterical. Like, yes. Really genuinely riotously funny. And so we used to go see her, and at some point she got diabetes and she had her leg amputated. Then she went on a tour with one leg.
It's the only time she's been under 200 pounds.
Exactly. Oh, boom. And she would come out in an electric wheelchair. I saw her at Westbury Music Fair in New York, and the place went crazy. And I think in that moment, I thought, I feel like such a weird freak. And look at this woman getting a standing ovation, being showered with love. It must have just hit me that this was a way that you could live your life. And also my family talked about her like she was the most special person in the world. Like, that's Molly's best friend is Toadie Fields. And I thought, oh, that's the kind of person you want to be. And then I was, you know, I was into the Marx Brothers and Abbott and Costello, and then it turned into George Carlin and Richard Pryor and Cosby, and then Steve Martin and Saturday Night Live and National Lampoon's Animal House. And when my parents got divorced, my mom took a job as a hostess at a comedy club. And looking back, I always think, on some cosmic level or personal level, she must have done that only for me, because how much can you get paid to seat people at the comedy club?
Right.
That's all she did is just
she
seat
sat
people.
Them.
She sat them.
She didn't cocktail waitress.
And this is an upper middle class or lower upper class woman going through a terrible divorce, and she takes that job. And so one summer, I watched every comedian in that club all summer long. Paul Prevenza came in, and Leno, and I think Harry Anderson, people like that in the early 80s. And then I said, oh, I want to talk to these people. How can I talk to these people? And my high school had a radio station. And I said, maybe I could do my own talk show. And I would go out with a little tape recorder and beg Seinfeld and Leno to talk to me. And before the internet and podcasts, they were all bored. No one wanted to talk to Jerry Seinfeld in 1983. I mean, other than maybe some morning radio, they weren't doing long-form interviews about the craft. So I was able to get everyone. And then that became college. Even when I was at USC, I thought I kind of learned most of the stuff from the 50 interviews about what I wanted to do. And I started when I was 17, and when I stopped, I was 24, and I started writing for television. But I was pretty obsessed with it. And it is an escape pod. You just think, how am I going to get out of this town? How am I going to pay my bills? And I really busted my ass to learn as much as I could.
Do you, I've told this to Judd before, but maybe some of the people listening don't know it, but many years ago when Jimmy and I were summoned into Ivan Reitman's office to create a comedy movie, a buddy movie, probably circa 2002 or 2003 or something, I think it was 2002, actually. Reitman doesn't mince words, and it's funny. I hesitate to call him a douche because he's not, but I've been yelled at him, and so is Jimmy. And
he's Frank.
He's Frank. He's Frank. Frank meets in a hurry, creates douche.
Brisk. Like, Frank meets Kurt. Yeah. They had a baby.
Yeah, he's Kurt and he's Frank and he's kind of, his time is money with him. And like, he'll tell you some stuff like, I told you X, Y, and Z on the script. And we'd be like, yeah, we didn't get around to it. And he'd be like, stop wasting my fucking time then. Like, stuff like that. But it's true because he's him. And we pitched him, Jimmy's a virgin. He's the 33-year-old virgin.
Oh, wow.
Like, he's 33, and I'm his buddy, and I'm going to get him laid, you know? And Ivan was like, that's a horrible fucking idea, and no one will ever go for it. No one is going to believe there's a 33-year-old guy who's a virgin. It's
Hold
a stupid fucking idea.
Now, you tell me he's a 40-year-old virgin, and we got something, and now you're cooking with gas.
But would he believe they were eagles who were legal?
Yes. Deborah Winger.
His greatest work.
So he just yelled at us for that idea.
But everyone turned that down, by the way.
I
pitched that everywhere, and only one place thought it was a good idea. I went to Sony, I remember, and I was pitching it. I'm like, I'm telling you, Carell's the guy. This is the idea. And they're like, Judd, just keep your eye on the ball with your other stuff.
Yeah. You know, my new move, because every time I talk to an author, they go, oh, before I was a New York Times bestseller, I was turned down by 15 publishing houses. My thing is whether it's Judd and his movie or the young author, how many times you've been turned down? Twice. Mm-hmm. Come back when it gets to like low teens.
Yeah, double digits.
Because I know how these stories go.
You barely started.
Just like the doctors who tell you to get your affairs in order, you maybe 2 years tops. Yeah. That was 41 years ago. Like, I want to be that doctor and that guy who turns down Judd Apatow. So for you, in a world where now your thoughts turn to things that are more of a serious nature, like, the Shandling documentary is very compelling. It's got a lot of pathos. It's got a lot of comedy, but it's also has a lot of very interesting, thought-provoking material in it. And as if you've stated earlier, this is sort of philosophically what you're thinking about. Are there projects in the future for you that have of a more serious nature? Razor's Edge. What was the Bill Murray?
That was Razor's Edge
movie. Yeah, there
it
is.
A very good book. But I don't know. I feel like sometimes you make these things in a trance. Even if it's 2 years, you're just obsessed on it. Then it ends, and then you think, what the hell just happened? And I don't know if I'll ever have a subject, both as a person and the ideas in it, that will ever be as strong as this one, because through Gary's life, you could talk about everybody's life. You could talk about spirituality and comedy, and almost everything I'm interested in is in this documentary. So hopefully I'll think of something else, but I don't have anything ahead of me that clearly covers that. But I really enjoyed writing the episode with Pete this year for Artie Lang on Crashing that was about Artie's addiction. It was great to try to make a very thoughtful, heartfelt episode about what Artie's struggling with. And we called Artie and said, let's talk about it. Let's not pretend this isn't happening. You're having issues and issues with addiction. And this is a gift you can give the world. Hey, this fucking sucks. This is painful. This is terrible. And maybe you could warn some people off of getting yourself into this situation. And he was really brave and hysterical and was able to do an episode that I think is as well acted as anything I've ever seen, and as honest as any type
Artie's
of acting
a really
I've
good
seen.
Actor who doesn't get credit, yeah. I think, for being as good an actor as he is.
He knows his craft. It's that he's not stumbling into it. He really knows what he's doing. And we would call him up and go, Artie, if someone was talking to you and you were bullshitting him that you weren't high, but you are high, even while you're bullshitting him, what would you say? And he would laid out. He's also a great writer. He's a guy of many talents. And so writing like that and work like that is very satisfying. But you know, at the same time, every once in a while, you know, something like Walk Hard will come on TV, which I worked on. And I thought that, you know, it's fun to just be really silly And there's a place to just try to make people piss their pants as your contribution to society. So I'm sure it may be that that's the move.
Is crashing – so speaking of crashing, I had a problem with my DVR and the solution was take the kids' DVR and like put it in my room. So I got a lot of their shit on my DVR now and I'm trying to get myself reconjiggered, but I haven't seen crashing in like 2 weeks. Is it?
It's over. It's over for this.
The last season. The last episode was the roast battle.
That was the last episode.
Oh, okay. Yes. All right. I've been searching. Yeah. It's such a good. It's really so well done because it has that pathos, but has tons of comedy, but it also has a sort of reality. It lives in a world that is just 100% reality. It doesn't have. It just doesn't have a lot of false notes, which you run into a lot when they do comedy.
Yes. I think that's probably the highest value for me, which I learned from Gary, is removing false notes. That's all Gary ever preached is truth, getting to the core, going as deep and as complex as you can get in the work.
Jeannie had a question.
Yeah, just along those lines, but in a fairly different genre. Love is one of the most amazing series I've ever seen. And I was so excited to see that it was coming back. And
Netflix.
And I was so mesmerized by the first episode by going, I live in L.A. and this really feels like L.A. This really feels like two people in this town, not what we want the rest of the world to think it feels like.
Sure.
And it's just so gripping and so amazing. And I couldn't help but wonder what it was like having your daughter as a pretty big story arc at one point.
Well, my daughter Iris is super funny. She's 15.
And like going on 45 in that, in her strength and in her humor.
Yeah, she's really tough and funny and very comfortable on the set, very comfortable acting. And she plays this spoiled child star. And it's
interesting. With the weight of the world on her shoulders.
Yeah, and she's kind of pissed off and over it already. And this year I directed an episode and wrote an episode to test her acting. So just for fun, I wrote an episode where she plays every emotion. She falls in love. She gets her heart broken. She's furious. She murders someone. And I just tried to put her through her paces. And she is incredible in the episode. And I'm really proud of her. She's tough on me. You know, kids are so tough. Like, I say this in stand-up, but it's true. Like, my daughter now lives alone with us because my oldest daughter went to college.
Maude.
And so the joke I say, but it does capture our lives, is she hates living just with her parents because four people is a family and three people is a child observing a weird couple.
Right.
And that is what our life is like now. Just her looking at us going like, what are you guys doing? You know, and teenage years are tricky. How old are your kids?
They're 11-year-old twins, but she's going on like 49 and... Like
he's holding steady.
She is. Yeah, he's, you know, she's. Well, what you realize is so I've always said this. I hope they're not listening. All right. It's going to be the name.
I'm on,
next
so
book.
You know they're listening.
Yeah. So here's the thing. I've always said, like, you can take an asshole and a laid back person and they can get along just fine.
Yeah.
And we've seen it at work a million times. And it's not even like we've had directors at the Man Show that had motors in them, had real strong opinions, would like kind of get in your face and whatever it is. And if you're wired as sort of a low resting pulse rate, like you have what Dr. Drew says I have, which is I can climb out of a race car and you can check my pulse and it's the same as if I was watching TV. I just don't have that. If a car backfires, I don't jump. I just I'm wired low. It's not great for getting stuff done, but it's great for not being startled.
Yes.
Not great for romance.
Not great for romance.
But great for romance.
Oh, or is it?
But if you take two people that are both hard chargers and super opinionated, and we won't call them assholes, we'll just say
type A
and headstrong
go-getters.
You put them together, they hate each other because they just see in each other what they see, and two laid-back people can work. A laid-back and a headstrong person can work, but two headstrongs come together, and as my daughter becomes headstrong, she now does battle with my wife and the nanny,
yeah.
who don't admit it, but they're super headstrong too. Yeah. And then my son and I just look at each other while yeah. these epic kitchen battles are taking place.
Well, girls are genetically programmed to turn on their moms at
yes.
some point.
Oh, good. That's right.
Right. There's yeah. just no way to stop it. You could just see it in their eyes.
On the house.
Well, it starts off with just like, who's wearing my shoes? Like, yes. which my son can't wear pumps, sure. or if he can,
no, yeah.
that'll come a little later yeah. in life. But the point is it starts with like borrowing clothes, yeah. borrowing makeup, mm-hmm. mussing yeah. with stuff. Like, you see all those who got into my yep. stuff, and there can be only one answer because right. there's Sonny, there's me, and there's Phil the Labrador. So the answer of who got into her stuff yeah. has to be the daughter. And then there's just some sort of battle yeah. for supremacy over who's going to rule the kitchen, not yeah. not by cooking, but by it's a land battle. It's not a yeah. it's not a cuisine related battle.
That was an ugly day in my house when they realized they had the same size shoe, and then you mm-hmm. thought, oh, we're off to the races now,
right?
Or just my the funniest is that my youngest daughter Iris is now taller than her older sister, who's 20. And so she'll borrow some clothes, and then Maude will flip out, and Iris just doesn't care at all because she's, you know, she could take her.
Right. And versus my son, I came into his room last night, and he was just sitting there listening to his Alexa, and I'm like, Alexa, and I said, what are you listening to? And he's like, I'm listening to Nirvana. And I said, oh, let me give you some suggestions. And then we switch over to Pearl Jam, then we switch over to old Joe Jackson.
Ooh,
and
listen
to some...
what a delightful experience youth must be for this child.
And then he's talking about how he loves I'm the Man, and we went over Look Sharp, the whole album, and I'm the Man, and everything else. And he's just... I always say it this way. I always go, look, I have a son and a daughter, and people say, what's it like? Boy and a girl, twins, what's that like? And I always go, raising my daughter is like raising three people, and raising my son is like raising one old cat. And that's basically yeah. exactly how it works out.
Yeah, my kids would rebel against my music. I dream of putting on a Joe Jackson record and having my daughters like it. Mm-hmm. But just recently, Iris, just out of the blue, you know, every day we go to school, she puts on her music. She doesn't want to talk the entire 20-minute drive to school. She does. That's her time to not talk. So she says very clearly, we're not going to talk. And then she just DJs the drive. And the other day, just out of the blue, she puts on the Pixies.
Wow.
Then a couple of days later, Heart.
Wow. Yeah,
like, and I'm like, wait, it's expanding. But I can't push it.
Don't get excited,
I can't push
off.
It.
Yeah, it's very true. He's into John Hyde and Graham Parker and Joe Jackson and whatever. And you can go, well, that's the stuff you like. And he like, yeah, well, I expose Natalia to the same stuff, but she's listening to Katy Perry and all the, yeah. you know, junky, popcorny. Ugh. Yep. Saccharine.
Lauryn
robot.
Hill just hit the playlist. I was very excited.
Oh, yeah. It is nice when they yeah. come around. All right. One more. Let's see. I want to tease. I'll tease a quickie for Judd. I know he's going to be out of here soon. You have 15 things going all the time, I'm guessing. Are there some part twos of Knocked Up? Or all the other Talladega Nights. We always talk about how much we love Talladega Nights and how not underappreciated, but in a weird way underappreciated in the just the pantheon of comedies yeah. because that movie had so many laughs in it. Maybe the subject was too broad or the comedy was too broad to get sort of put in the snooty guy's top 10 comedy, but the laughs were all there. But What are you working on? What's mm-hmm. what can you tell us about? What's a follow up to yeah. or something we'll know? And or are we going to do some more documentaries? I'll tell you guys about ZipRecruiter, man. Hiring, every business needs great people and a better way to find them. ZipRecruiter built a platform to find the right candidates for you. ZipRecruiter learns what you're looking for, identifies people with the right experience, and invites them to apply to your job. 80% of employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate in just one day. Imagine that, 80% in just 24 hours. The right candidates are out there. ZipRecruiter is how you find them. So what do you do? Well, right now, my listeners can try ZipRecruiter for free. You just go to ZipRecruiter.com/Adam. ZipRecruiter.com/Adam if you're looking for somebody or maybe you want to be found. ZipRecruiter.com/Adam. Smartest way to hire is with our good friends over at ZipRecruiter. I am playing Cleveland, the Agora. Is that it?
The Agora Theater.
Agora Theater, that's May 16th. Detroit Royal Oak, May 17th. Madison, Wisconsin, I think that one's going to sell out. That's April 6th. And then we're doing a live podcast, Santa Ana Esports Arena. Portland, Aladdin Theater, two shows. We'll do a stand-up special there. And Seattle, the Moore Theater, live podcast. Check that out. Go to AdamCarolla.com. Where did you shoot your stand-up special?
I shot it in Montreal at the Plaza des Arts, something French. And I love the Moore Theater in Seattle.
So beautiful.
We did the train wreck tour there, and that was incredible. Eddie Vedder came to that show.
Well, that was
exciting.
You know, the when people do the, when did you realize you'd showed up, you made it, or something? I have two. One, when Axl Rose asked a question about me.
It's I love that.
1994. Like someone said, Axl said he thought you'd be older or something. Axl Rose had a question about me. And then the other was playing the Moore Theater and looking up in the balcony and picturing Eddie Vedder swinging from the lighting rig in Evenflow. And I was like, wow, I'm on the same stage as Eddie Vedder?
That place is that's a perfect comedy.
It's beautiful.
And you're taping a special.
I'm taping a special in Portland at the Aladdin Theater on June 9th. And that's why I was asking, because when I was watching your special, you were walking down the streets in New York and you were going down in like the Comedy Cellar and stuff like that. But then you ended up at a place that didn't look like that.
Well, that was in the commercials was me asking advice from different comedians about doing a special and them all discouraging me. And Chris Gethard, and Birbiglia just saying, you have so much to lose, everything. But I prepared at the Cellar in New York and I went to like the DC Improv and some other clubs to prepare. But
it was, forgive me for being technical for a second. But just as a guy who's getting ready to shoot one.
I use the red cam.
I'm curious about, did you do two?
Four.
Four.
And show four is the one I used mainly.
Just pretty much just used the whole show.
Because I'm a choker, and if I had to do it in one night, I could have a bad first set, and then second set be so nervous the first one went bad, and then tank the second set. So I actually did four shows. They all went pretty well, but most of it is from the last show, and that cost me some dough. They don't want to have you do multiple nights, but I thought, you know what? This is important to me, and I'd like to get it.
How big was the room? It was raked nice. I mean, it looked nice. Yeah, I couldn't tell.
A little under 300, and I wanted to have it feel a little more intimate, like a club. I generally am not a big fan of shows where there's 3,000 or 5,000. I feel like the Moore Theater is the perfect size, like the 1,200, 1,500 for me when I watch comedy. I don't need there to be another 30,000 people I can't see there. Mm-hmm. I like the sound of laughs when it's not like an Elton John concert.
And I saw you had some notes, some sheets of stuff, some cheat notes, for lack of a better term, out on your bench with you. But I didn't know. I never saw you really glance at them or look at them. I didn't know if it was a menu of jokes or beats or something. And I was kind of looking at, you could see in a few shots, like, oh, he's got a mug of water and I'm assuming it was water and a couple of notes, but he's never seemed to be referring to them.
Well, on that piece of paper I had, I read this poem I wrote when I was 14 about my parents' divorce. Mm-hmm. So that was one of the bits. And then I'm sure underneath it, I had a set list in case I just had a wide-eyed panic and couldn't remember anything. So I didn't have to look at it, but it was there in case I flipped out.
So projects coming up.
Projects. Well, the main thing is Love on Netflix and Crashing streaming on HBO. Gary Shandling documentary. The Avett Brothers documentary, which is streaming on HBO, which people have really liked. Mm-hmm.
Wait, I did not see that one.
The Avett Brothers is this great country, rock, folk, Americana band that we followed for on and off for about 2 years. And it's very different than the Gary doc in some ways, because it's about two brothers that really love each other and get along and are happy. You know, it's the opposite of the super neurotic creative person, although you do see them writing and recording and how they take their lives and what's happening and turn it into creativity. So it's similar in that way. But that's a very good documentary with some great music in it. And then the masterclass, which, you know, I don't know if it's masterclass.org or .com, but if you are interested in writing and directing and performing, I try to put down on video what I generally tell people when I'm mentoring them. And I learned a lot about mentoring from Gary, who mentored me. And that was something that he cared about. You know, Gary had this crazy experience where he was 20 years old and he went to go see George Carlin. And Carlin wasn't a big star yet, because he just became the hippie George Carlin.
Mm-hmm.
And he wrote jokes for him. He tried to, like, sell him jokes. And he got Carlin at the bar to talk to him. And Carlin said, come back tomorrow. I'll have read them. And he comes back and they're laid out on a table. And he had little markings on them. And he said, you know what? I don't buy jokes, but there's a great one on every page. So if you want to be in comedy, I would pursue it. And Gary just moved to California. And I always felt like that planted the seed for mentorship in Gary, that, you know, that kind of encouragement can change somebody's life.
Yeah, I agree. And I'd like to dig a pit and fill it with all the people that did the opposite of that.
Exactly. You know, told you to stop.
Coming up, like, where they just went, I'm not seeing it, or I don't think so, or you should get your contractor's license, or whatever that thing was.
Start with Mr. and Mrs. Carolla.
Yeah. Well, if you think about it, it's a two-way street, this mentorship, if you think about it, because if you said to George Carlin, hey, man, how about it? And he went, hey, there's something here. If he crumpled it up and wiped his ass with it and threw it at him and said, look, I'm a pro and I'm telling you now, don't waste your time. Well, in a way, that could be worse than the is worse than positive, but mm-hmm. would be worse than anything that could happen. Like, that could stymie a yeah. career. You could destroy
that.
A career.
That's a story in my stand-up special, is Jim Henson of the Muppets did that to me. I auditioned for Jim Henson. He tried to buy all my pitches for what could be in the show, and they said that they didn't want me on the show. They just want me as a writer because he thought I lacked warmth. And it devastated me. It might have been why I didn't do comedy for 22 years. Because I thought, this is Kermit the Frog. I mean, this is a guy who can take ping pong balls and make it the warmest character in the world.
Right.
And he's telling me I lack warmth. Although I kind of don't believe it. I just don't believe that the casting director didn't just say it. I can't believe that he said it. I think that it must have been a casting
who
director.
Who lacks warmth now?
That's right.
Oh, geez, Brian. That's,
you are dark.
Wow. Well, again, I was there when they wanted me to do a radio show. And like I said, I don't want to do it alone, but how about we do it with me and my buddy Jimmy Kimmel do it? And the program director's like, he's not on air talent. Oh. He's producer. He's writer. He's behind the glass talent, but he's not on air, not in front of the microphone talent.
I have so many of those.
Everybody
stories does.
And my point is, I don't know, maybe that's your opinion. Obviously, you need a recalibration if that is your opinion, but why are you sharing it so readily with
so
everybody?
Convicted.
I have one of those. We went in and met with the head of Fox Movies during In Living Color, and me and my manager, who represented Jim Carrey at the time, said, we think Jim Carrey's a giant movie star. And they just said, nope. They had no interest whatsoever.
He's a commercial, and that's it.
And it was at Fox. That's this is your guy. He's already on the lot. He's 50 feet from here. And there's so many of those. Seth Rogen, I couldn't get to be the lead of Undeclared. They were like, no. Nope. I mean, they laughed at me when I said it.
That it's a weird and somewhat unfair business, because If I walked into any college campus with a 19-year-old Herschel Walker and went, this guy's going to carry the rock for your team, they wouldn't go, get the fuck out of here.
I know talent.
They'd just see his quads pushing through his slacks and his guns, and they'd go, what's his 40 time? And you go, I don't know, in flip-flops, maybe 4.4. And he can, how many times can he put up 220 pounds? I don't know, because we lose count. Like, we all get bored and we go somewhere to eat. When he gets to like 35, we go to the Applebee's and we come back and he's still doing it. And you go, fuck yeah, that guy's on our team. And there's no such thing as Shaquille O'Neal walking into his high school coach's office and going, I'm going to play some. And he's like, how about you pick up a mop instead? Like, there is none of that in comedy. That's all there is.
Yeah.
It's you standing in front of unfunny people going, how about you give me a chance? And they're going, I don't think so.
Oh, I have this funny story about Shandling where he
and also, let me just say it and tell me this story. But also, the problem is yes, nobody looks like anything. You know, Seth Rogen doesn't look like a leading man, and Gary Shandling doesn't look, and Jimmy Kimmel. Nobody when they're 25 looks like anything. So how can you say that?
Yep.
And if he looked like Rock Hudson, he wouldn't be funny. Yep. All right, sorry, go ahead.
This is a story that isn't in the doc, but it made me laugh. Gary wrote a script for Welcome Back, Kotter. And then he got in a terrible car accident, like a really bad car accident, and almost died and had this near-death experience. And then Gary called the head writer there, and he said, if you would say that you were about to hire me to be a full-time staff writer, I would get a lot of insurance money because I can't work because I'm injured. And the writer, who didn't think Gary was a great writer, said, so, but you definitely can't write on the show. And Gary said, yeah. He goes, okay, well, then you could tell them I was going to hire you.
Oh, my God.
Right. Welcome back, Kotter. As popular, but as cookie cutter and formulaic a sitcom there ever was. Up your nose with a rubber hose. Hey, sit on it. All right. Oh, that was Fonzie. All right. Let me tell you about Castrol Edge. If you're going up your nose with a rubber hose, you need good lubrication, man, or you will tear some cartilage. I recommend Castrol.
Why is the best, everyone?
Castrol Edge. Tech advances made engines smaller. The only thing that's stopping the metal-to-metal contact is a thin layer of oil, so you need a strong motor oil. I suggest Castrol Edge. It's formulated with fluid titanium technology, three times stronger. Three times.
Three times, fool.
Three times stronger against viscosity breakdown than the leading full synthetic. It's the best. It's Castrol Edge. Judd Apatow, what a delight. We're we're better planet with you on it. We really are.
That.
And all the amazing work that comes through you, and not the least of which is the Zen Diaries of Gary Shandling. That is part one airs this Monday, March 26th, HBO, 8 o'clock. Part two is following day, Tuesday, March 27th. I watch them and be inspired. You really do not have to be into comedy at all to get something from this very unique and well-told story. I will be watching it again. I've already seen it once. I will enjoy it again. And, of course, Love Season 3, now available on Netflix. And you can shoot him a tweet, at Judd Apatow. And anything else, Judd?
So happy to be here. So excited to see your K-Rock doc whenever it gets out to the world.
We're working hard on it, but I'll give you a sneak preview of Uppity, the Willie T. Ribs doc.
Yeah.
And you can enjoy that, and then we'll take it from there. All right, let's see. Who's out there?
Chet Waterhouse.
Chet Waterhouse is out there. We'll be back with him right after a break in Good Sport.
Adam Carolla is bringing his New York Times bestseller, Not Taco Bell Material, back to the stage this winter.
The reason the show is called Not Taco Bell Material is because I attempted to get a job at the Taco Bell in North Hollywood that was by my house, and they said, thanks, but no thanks.
In Madison, Wisconsin, at the Capitol Theater on April 6th.
We're looking for a slightly higher caliber of retard.
Adam Carolla, Not Taco Bell Material. Just added, Cleveland, May 16th, Detroit, May 17th.
Now I'm out on my own, and I've moved on to the fast-paced, lucrative world of carpet cleaning.
Adam Carolla,
where a high school diploma will only slow you down, people.
Not Taco Bell material. And don't miss The Adam Carolla Show live, April 21st in Santa Ana, California. Get your tickets now at adamcarolla.com. Podcast One Sports Network presents Good Sports.
Hi and hello, sports fans. Welcome to this Podcast One Sports presentation of Good Sports. Dave Damashek here. Adam Carolla over there. The hump week edition of the show, Ace. And as promised, we got to talk a little NFL free agency. Really, NFL matters. And really, the climate to me is troubling. Up in Foxborough, it seemed like heading into the first Sunday of February, it was a done deal. At least that's kind of how I regarded it, that the Eagles, nice story, but come on, Tom Brady and Belichick are going to whip them as they are inclined to do. And instead, here we are, they lose that game. Now all they have is a 42-year-old Tom Brady and a lot of question marks. What's your concern level, 1 to 10, Ace, about the New England Patriots?
Concern level is them, I guess, becoming mediocre and thus not having a heavyweight division with a Muhammad Ali in it or Mike Tyson in it, where you could, now it's just like the Klitschko brothers fighting a bunch of other guys that are 6'8", who's from some former Soviet republic that you've never heard of. Like a general loss in interest because the 300-pound or the 800-pound gorillas left the room.
The reference I always make is, what would Star Wars be without Darth Vader? That's exactly right. Baseball needs the Yankees to be good, and college football needs Notre Dame to be prominent. These things, even if you don't root for certain teams, you want them in the league to root against.
Yeah, I would. I don't want to live in a world where the Pats are 10 and 6 or 9 and 7 or something like that. I don't want that world.
Well, what's weird is it's fairly clear to me and I think to most people who watch the game, the thing that you never would think would happen is that Belichick would get outsmarted. Whatever else goes down, maybe you lose a game, but it wouldn't be because of Belichick. But that's pretty much the case with that Super Bowl against the Eagles as you look back. He decided to bench Malcolm Butler, hero of Super Bowl 49, obviously picks off Russell Wilson in that one. And he benches Malcolm Butler. I think you can make a pretty compelling case. I don't know anybody what the argument against it is even. If he casts Malcolm Butler in there, they win, right? And he benches him, and there's no good reason for it.
I do not know in life in general if there is something we don't know, or it's just he missed curfew or smelled like weed or whatever it was. I don't know. I'm trying to think how many other coaches in the league would have done that. I also wonder, sometimes if Belichick, his greatest coaching asset is to make everyone around him feel like everyone's expendable at any given time, and has proven it so many times that nobody save Tom Brady ever thinks that their position is guaranteed, that their starting role is guaranteed, that all he does is prove to the world, the owners and all his team, I can do it without you. So let me reinforce this once again, that biggest game of the year, best DB on the team, don't need him because he was 10 minutes late to a meeting.
I know.
You know more about football than I do. What was the actual reason?
I'm telling you, I've talked to a lot of people, including, Willie McGinnis is tied in, obviously, with the Patriots organization, during the playoff run. I asked him pointedly about all that stuff. I mean, that's the strife because Brady and Garoppolo and getting Garoppolo out from underneath so that that wasn't something that looms currently, that went, well, 42-year-old Brady versus the kid Garoppolo, and how much are we going to pay this guy? Or is it doing their mutual agent, Don Yee, a solid by trading Garoppolo away to a good spot? However that all goes down, it clearly didn't sit well between Brady, Belichick, and Kraft. It seems as though Kraft took Brady's side and they traded away the threat to Brady. Right. And Belichick was like, well, we need this guy. We need a backup QB. What do we have? We're going to get Brian Hoyer otherwise. I don't think that sat well. But now on top of it, how do you think Brady feels? I mean, he's not going to get that many more shots at another ring. And Belichick directly cost him one by benching Malcolm Butler. But the story, to answer your question, is it's unclear. It seems as though Belichick maybe misinterpreted what was going on. Malcolm Butler claims he was sick earlier in the week, and they thought maybe it was because he was out on twisters and or something like that, out doing who knows what. But Malcolm Butler, to this day, you would think something would have emerged by now if there was something nefarious that led to Malcolm Butler being tardy early in the week.
Right.
And it has not.
Mm.
It's very weird.
Very weird. But
I wonder what it'll go down. But as it stands currently at the time of this recording, and free agency moves fast, so maybe things have changed a little bit. But as it currently stands, you have a 42-year-old QB and a whole lot of nothing otherwise. I mean, you have a couple of good players out there. You have a banged-up Gronk. Who knows what the future is going to hold? But I'm with you, Ace. I think ultimately, yes, people like to root against the evil empire, whether it's the Yankees or Darth Vader or the Patriots. But I think everybody will miss it when it's gone.
I was thinking about a young Dave Damashek.
Mm.
And all this free agency, everyone's heading off to parts unknown every year, it seems like. You growing up, being a huge Steelers fan, and having a Franco Harris, a Rocky Blyer, right, a Mean Joe Green, a L.C. Greenwood, Jack Splatt, Jack Ham.
Keep it going, Ace!
All right, let's see.
Dwight White!
All right, let's see. DB's...
the best.
I was going to say Mel Blunt.
There you go.
And
31. Hard hitter.
Wagner. Donnie Wagner.
That's right. Mike Wagner. That's
Mike
right.
Wagner.
It was great.
So I know all these guys' names. I was in L.A.
That's so right, isn't it?
Because they stayed together.
I am with you. I just had this conversation last week. It is the debate of, like, what do you like better? Was it better to be a sports fan in the 20th century versus 21st century? And, you know, obviously, all the cable sports networks out there that
Donnie
show you
Schell,
every game.
Sorry, Mike Wagner, right. Donnie Schell, Mel Blunt. You could set me down.
That's right.
I grew up in North Hollywood. I did not know where I didn't know Pittsburgh was in Pennsylvania. I saw Pittsburgh. Like, I didn't know. When I grew up, I had no geographic anything. I grew up in the San Fernando Valley with poor people. Like, we didn't even have a map. I never even knew. I had no idea where Penn State was from. I called the Nifty Lions. I had no idea. I called the Nebraska Corn Huskers the Corn Hustlers. I didn't know what a husk. I'd never seen a husk. I had no idea that Notre Dame was in Indiana. I would never. I was 37 when I was surprised. In Indiana? What? I had no idea. I didn't know where anything was. I didn't even know where Pittsburgh was in Pennsylvania. I didn't know where it was. I could name, when I was 12, I could name probably 9 or 10 out of the starters on the offense and 9 or 10 out of the starters on the defense of the Pittsburgh Steelers.
I completely agree with what you're pointing out here. I think that year after year, that those usual suspects, whether you rooted for or against them, meant more in the 20th century, and free agency has disrupted that, made sports vaguely less satisfying. Yes, although it satisfies your short-term satisfaction more, because it's what you rob Peter to pay Paul. When the games are actually being played, you want what you're describing. You want the same guys on the same teams year after year. But at least in March, when free agency is going down, it's like, ooh, did you hear so-and-so? Ndamukong Suh might go where? You know, like,
now
those
you
guys
sound like Lynette. And let's not forget Dirt Winston.
Oh, my very favorite, Ace. He was my very favorite. There was Dirt Winston. All right. Ace Carolla, Dave Damashek, Podcast One Sports, Good Sports, back for more tomorrow. Till then, out. Good Sports.